All right, so yesterday we talked about postmodernism, history of it, motivations, and I think one of the things that's important in all these philosophies is to understand how circumstances in life motivate people down certain paths, right? We come up with philosophies. All of these philosophies are not the result, any worldly philosophy is not the result of somebody randomly sitting around and just thinking something up. It is always a response to circumstances, driving forces, cultural forces, and we are no less influenced by those today. And we continue to come up with various philosophies. Usually, they're rehashing of some old philosophy, but it's often motivated by circumstances in our culture and in our lives. Well, we talked about how postmodernism has affected American culture. And again, I think we see it very, very obviously. It's jolting to us to see the sort of latest iterations of these philosophies. We need to be concerned about less jolting philosophies that affect us, that are more just the world we inhabit, and often need to take a step back. I think one of the dangers is we're so disturbed by by these latest stages of postmodernism that it makes us even more complacent with previous philosophies that are just as abiblical or anti-biblical. And so that's one of the things I'll talk about here. Don't let these latest heresies acclimate you to previous heresies. We need to be examining all of those presuppositions and so forth. Well, I just want to go through and talk fairly quickly about some of the ways that I think postmodernism affects our affects Christians, affects our teaching and preaching. And hopefully I'll have a little bit of time with what time is left to me to get into some of the responses, because that's really where I want to spend my time and all of our time tomorrow. And there's enough to talk about there that I feel like I need to get a jump on it today. So ways that we've been affected, where have we become postmodernists? Well, I think the priority of the individual experience. So in the worst case, this plays out in people just making wild rejections of plain biblical teaching. You, I'm sure, have seen various ways in which Christian evangelists and preachers, teachers on YouTube and wherever else are basically proposing a way of acceptance of all sorts of debauchery and saying, you know, actually, you know, we haven't taken into account the individual experience, and Christ is here for the sufferer, and here's these people suffering, and therefore we prioritize and acknowledge their individual experience and so forth. So those are sort of radical ways that we do that. But I think in more common practice and in our experience, what we find is that we often make room for the individual experience, maybe in our Bible studies and so forth. We often speak in terms of, well, you know, the way I've always seen it or always heard it, and then we allow that to take precedence over the scriptures. We were in a Bible study with Brother Waldron one time, and he had read through 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And a fellow was in the class, and he said, you know, I've always heard that you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. And that was sort of his own experiential response to Paul's apostolic guidance on how to deal with sin among us. Brother Waldron just looked at him silently for a minute and said, well, let's just read what Paul says again. And I think we need more of that. When somebody says, what I've found to be true, well, what you mean is what you found to work within your framework. I need to be willing to set aside what I've found to be true. That is a postmodernist conceit. The phrase, what does this passage mean to you? I know there's a way in which we could use that language accommodatively. And maybe what we're saying is, how does it apply? You know, how do you find this passage to apply in your life? But in its worst sense, what we're saying is, set aside original intent and tell me how you feel about this passage. This is all very postmodernist. And I think we need to be very careful that we're constantly pulling people away from their own sensations and their own experiences and towards original intent, towards what is Paul doing with this. In fact, take people out of their own experiences and into the century in which this is written. This is a question I ask my students in going through Genesis. At the end of every lesson, I ask this question: what do you think Israel was supposed to learn from what Moses was writing here? And from that, then we can begin to see, then what am I supposed to learn? But we so quickly jump to my individual experience that maybe we're losing the narrative, losing the point. Another way in which I think this has affected us is the prioritization, this kind of goes along with it, of community or spiritual experience over doctrine. Now, I do not want at all, I think modernism minimizes these things very often. It minimizes spiritual experience and so forth. My problem is not an emphasis on these things, but a dichotomy between this and doctrine. Biblically, these things should be working in harmony. And so what we've done, what this is an overreaction to the exaltation of doctrine, to the suppression of spiritual or community experience. I remember years ago, a preacher, I'd used the word, living in community. And because of this, a preacher was like, hey, what are you saying there about community? And I'm like, that doctrine is to be lived out in community. And he was like, we need to be careful with those kind of words, like community. Well, that's an overreaction. But an emphasis on doctrine has caused this overreaction. And it doesn't matter what you believe, it matters who you believe. It's not about rules, it's about relationship and those sorts of things. Obviously, it is about relationship. That is governed by rules, And so we want to preach in ways that bring those things into harmony. And Bob's been talking a lot about that this week. Deconstruction. If you've not heard this terminology, this is a postmodern term. And it is a term that we should be alarmed at. There are guys who are saying deconstruction can actually be productive. Well, deconstruction, as presented by the postmodernists, actually cannot be productive. Fundamentally, it is meant to be the opposite of productive. It is meant to tear down. And some people will say, well, we need to tear down our faith in order to examine it to build up something true. That's not the point of deconstruction. Deconstruction is about destruction, right? It is like Nietzsche coming in like a wrecking ball and just saying, let me disabuse you of all of your notions. What we need to do certainly is make honest examinations of what we believe. Absolutely. But this is a destructive way of going about that. And I have yet to see the person who deconstructed so that they could reconstruct. This is a pathway out. But it gives somebody some sense of nobility that all they're doing is facing the realities or something like that. And so deconstruction of faith is not a valuable thought process, a valuable way to go about examining our beliefs. We need to recognize the hermeneutic of suspicion. The hermeneutic of suspicion is a hermeneutic. It's a way of interpreting that questions the motives of everyone. So when applied directly to the Bible, and sometimes that's the case. So we open up our Bibles I was listening to a series of lectures on the Old Testament last year, year before, and this woman with a PhD in biblical studies and so forth, which is, let me just say, a meaningless designation. Like it doesn't, it just means that they've read a lot of nonsense. That's all that means. Whether they've done well with that or not is, you know, individually assessed. But what she was doing, she was going through the period of Josiah. And you know, what is your estimation of Josiah? Yeah, one of the best, right? All right. She says the reason Josiah is making all of the reforms is to centralize power. It's to get power back in Jerusalem. He was afraid of the dissemination of power, and he wanted to bring back centralized government. And so it was all about accumulating power. Now, does the Bible present Josiah that way? Absolutely not. But when we're looking at history, let me ask this then. If you're reading history and you're reading maybe a Caesar's autobiographical accounts of his works, do you view with suspicion maybe what Augustus might say about his own? Yeah, you would. That's what they're doing with the Bible, right? They're taking that same suspicion that you and I would have about somebody like Caesar Augustus, and they're having that suspicion about the Word of God, which goes back to the modernist conceits of let's view this as if it's just a secular work. Well, it's not just a secular work. And we need to acknowledge the divine historian in all of that. This is a way that people are viewing, for instance, the destruction of Canaan. They're viewing with suspicion the motives of Israel. So what they're doing is saying, I don't know how to reconcile the destruction of Canaan with my picture of the character of God. Therefore, what I'm going to do is just say Israel probably just got it wrong and then ascribed their own motivations to God. And that's how they reinterpret through a hermeneutic of suspicion. Now, what's more frequent, and again, among our circles, that's kind of like more liberal theology, radical than you would usually hear in one of our brethren pulpits. What's more common is the hermeneutic of suspicion directed toward our own brethren. So this is what's happening with command, example, necessary inference is, they're just trying to establish an authoritative way of telling people what to do or something like that, right? It questions the motives of, so it's not just suspecting the Bible, but it's suspecting the people who interpret the Bible. So you've heard this, right? I mean, when you hear these guys, they're like, I tell you what they're trying to do. It's the patriarchy or some sort of motive questioning of that sort. And we need to be careful that we don't also engage in this. You know, somebody asked yesterday about John Mark Hicks' motivations. What's he trying to accomplish here? I think, listening and reading to him, I think he genuinely believes this stuff. And somebody's like, well, it can't be genuine. It can. People can be genuinely wrong, like really, really wrong, and really believe it all. And so there doesn't have to be some nefarious motives. Often they just believe wrong things. And we don't want to engage in suspicion and character assassination when that's unnecessary. Well, there is then skepticism of expertise and of authority. Now, I realize that expertise has been way overplayed, and that we live in a culture where the expert has claimed authority that he does not and never has had. Expertise always ought to come with a degree of humility. But it doesn't mean expertise doesn't exist. And that's part of the problem, that what we find is we find an expert that has overplayed his hand and pretended to know more than he actually did, and then that makes us question all expertise. It doesn't, if you are engaged in any kind of craftsmanship, it doesn't take long to figure out there are people who are experts at what they do. The area of knowledge, I think, is a little more difficult because, you know, somebody who is a carpenter, it's easy to tell the difference between somebody that's got expertise and somebody that doesn't, because the one with expertise's work is still standing. But with the expertise and knowledge, we're evaluating things that maybe we don't even have the knowledge to evaluate. Postmodernism says, without even evaluating, without even having the knowledge, you can dismiss it all if it doesn't fit your current perceived reality. And I think we are dismissive of expertise and authority. And this goes along with an overexaltation of the individual, the democratization of all knowledge. I hear guys say sometimes, they'll get up and they'll say, listen, I'm not here to be a teacher. I'm just here to participate and guide a discussion among us. James says, let not many of you become teachers. Maybe somebody's trying to live that out and say, I'm not going to be a teacher. But if you're not going to be a teacher, sit down. And let somebody who has spent enough time to develop a degree of expertise get up and teach. We need to have the knowledge to teach if we're going to teach. And that takes time and effort and work. And what we want is to put everybody on the same level. We want to put the person who has not thought a single thing about this text till he sat down in that Bible class on the same level with the guy that's been preparing for 2 years to teach this class. It's not true. And we need to be careful about that, that we don't fall into, I understand the motivations, but it is a trap. Another thing that goes along with this is the suspicion and skepticism toward the authority of elders. It's led to a notion that elders don't actually lead, they just influence. They don't have any right to make decisions, and every judgment call that the elders make is lording it over. I'll tell you what, during COVID, for instance, lots of judgment calls had to be made. And they could not all be made by committee. Because let me tell you, that committee would have been a wreck. It was hard enough among elderships. And so people were like, what gives them the right? God. God has set men. The notion is, let us agree on who the wise men among us are. Let us give them authority and let us submit to that authority. That is the idea. And the notion that they're just influencers leaves us really not much in a different position as not having them at all. Now, obviously there can be abuses, but those abuses should not be reasons to abandon the pattern. It should be rather reason to preach against those abuses. So we need authority. We need authority structures. God wants authority structures. And I would say this even in our attitudes towards government. I, as much as anybody, am a fan and proponent of limited government. I am distrustful of government. But I picked up a book a moment ago. I am not an anarchist. I can tell you what's far worse than government bureaucrats, and that is no government at all. That's a disaster. And so we want to acknowledge what God has said on that. You need leaders. Chaos is what results when you don't have that. Even bad leaders are better than no leaders at all. So appreciate that, and we need to inculcate that, especially in an American context where this really, you know, finds a welcome place in our hearts. Well, then finally, I want to suggest that in our teaching and preaching, there can be an overreaction to postmodernism. And one of the problems is a dismissal of all the concerns of postmodernism. We talked about that yesterday. Postmodernism is often so ridiculous that we can't see the legitimacy of the criticisms. Nietzsche, if you read through all of Nietzsche, is a raving madman at times. But ironically, in the book titled Madman, where he presents himself as a raving madman, he is saying true things. He is pointing out true criticisms. And we are ushering people into the hands of those madmen by not acknowledging what's true. When somebody makes a critique that is valid and we dismiss it out of hand, then we are inviting people who see that same true criticism to gravitate towards that. What we need to do, again, and I said this yesterday, what we need to do is say, now that is true. Now let me show you the boundaries that keep you from getting to where he is. It may be true that they see some inconsistencies. And we ought to admit that and say, fair enough. But there are still fences here. In a conversation on marriage, divorce, and remarriage in Coleman years ago, I was talking about multiple causes for divorce. And there were questions that came up after that. And people said, what do we do about these scenarios? And I said, I don't have all the answers for you. Cases of spousal abuse and things like that. What do we do? And I said, I don't have all the answers. But the answer I do have is we have to stay inside these boundaries. What I know is that God has not allowed divorce for any of those causes. So that's not an option. And we can have our conversations in the context of going ahead and taking that off the table and operate certainly within those boundaries. Now, what are the options with those? Well, that's a conversation. And I'm open to that conversation. But set those boundaries in place. And I think that's a way, you know, if we just say like, oh, you know, spousal abuse, that's not even a real problem. It's a problem. It's a reality. And if we're dismissive of that, then what we are doing is inviting people into the hands of somebody who gives them a way to deal with that. We need to acknowledge, yes, that's a hard question, but we at least know these things cannot be the answer. All right. Those are some of the ways that I think that we're affected by postmodernism. I want to then spend some time talking about our response. And before I do that, does anybody have any questions or comments before we move over to this other consideration? Yes.
You talked about skepticism towards experts. And I don't know how much you want to get into this, but how do we properly evaluate experts when we may not be in a position to, you know, to know whether or not they're telling us the truth? You know, in a position of somebody who's not as informed as they might be.
Right.
How do we work that?
So one thing I would say is just start with some humility and acknowledge, I don't know. I don't know. I cannot fully evaluate what I don't know. We evaluate with what we do know about God's word, right? So when somebody claims expertise and is teaching something that I know is contrary to God's word, okay, I'm not saying you don't have a lot of expertise, but I know you're wrong on this. Richard Dawkins knows way more about biology than I do, but he's a fool when it comes to God. And I can evaluate, I can distinguish those claims and say, I can't evaluate everything he's saying about biology. I don't have enough knowledge. I can evaluate what he's saying about God. And I think that's part of it. And I think that's part of the misery of the modern expert is that he gets outside of his lane and tries to deal with things he's not an expert on, but he uses the expertise he does have to give him authority to talk on those things he doesn't have authority on. Yes, Jake. Back to Dawkins, let me just pick on him a little bit. Of the big atheists that were coming out in the early 2000s, Dawkins is the worst philosopher. His logic is terrible. there are so many non sequiturs. And so you can at least see, you can be like, okay, what you just said doesn't prove that. And so I don't know about this claim you made, but I know it doesn't prove this next claim you made, right? You can break down the logical difficulties and say, I can't evaluate everything you're saying. And I think that's part of it, is just admit, I can't evaluate everything you're saying. And maybe what you're saying here is right because you know more than I do, but I know you're using faulty reasoning and that your arguments don't work regardless of your level of expertise. Marshall? Yeah. Yeah, in theological terms, I really like the books that are like four views on, you know, whatever. And you're getting representations of each of those, and it helps to make an evaluation.
I guess the danger I've seen in myself and in others in doing that is I pick my experts, right?
Sure.
You know, the ones that say that what I want to hear, and I'm not really evaluating.
Yeah. And all I can say is honesty and humility is what's got to win the day there. Colton? The expert.
No. The Christians that have gone deconstruction.
Oh.
That they have never come out the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Or mostly even believing in God. Yeah.
I'll just say one more thing. Studying for Romans, I read someone who believes both in Judaism. I read someone who believes in New Perspective. I read someone who holds a traditional view. I mean, if we only
Well, and let me say this. I give weight to somebody who has earned my trust, right? So, I mean, for instance, I'll just give you an example, is that the Gentile audience of Romans, right? There are people I would not have considered that from, but when Marshall brings it, I'm like, okay, well, I need to think about that then, because Marshall's earned my trust. And so I think we need to acknowledge and grant trust that has been gained and earned along those lines, and not just say, well, what does he know? I mean, a lot, you know.
Is that kind of along the lines of what Paul says, remember who?
Yes. Yeah, that's right. The loyalty is not something we should just throw in the trash can. We shouldn't overemphasize it, but it's something. Brent?
Don't listen to people who lie to you.
Yeah, you're right.
So,
yeah.
We get so much information flowing our way, and oftentimes not identified where it's coming from, but when there's been occasions where deception has happened,
yeah,
we should hopefully
right.
have our ears up for future.
We can categorize somebody as a liar. Tom, real quick, and then Jake, you got something else? Okay, Tom.
Yeah, I was going to say, from a religious standpoint, we used to publish debates.
Yeah, yeah.
Between brethren, and a well-developed debate, there's a reason we're not afraid to publish
yeah.
a well-developed debate, because you can look at the sides and you can see the flaws
yeah.
in the argument of, you know, like once they've always said or something
yeah.
like that.
There's a reason that that we don't publish them as much, because well-developed debate is hard to come by. Shouldn't be, but all right. Let's move on here to our response, and this is where I really want to spend a lot of our time. And so I'm gonna deal with a couple of elements this morning, and then that'll leave us enough time, I hope, to deal with the rest of the arguments I want to make tomorrow. So we talked about René Descartes and how he begins with the self. And I think that's at the root of our response, is that we have to begin with God. That we have to put him at the center and not our own rationalizations. I don't mean we don't use rational thought, but our rational thought is built on the premise that God created it, not the other way around. And we are operating under the assumption that God gave us the ability to speak or to think and to speak, and not that it is my own thinking ability that gets me to God. It's the other way around. So in Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7, Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 7, he says, "The fear Yahweh, the fear of Yahweh is the beginning of knowledge. Ignorant fools despise wisdom and discipline." And of course, this is throughout the Proverbs. Proverbs are often syllogisms, propositions, rational statements, but they're all on the premise of God is at the core. He's at the center. And so you fear him, and you make that the foundation of all of your knowledge. Again, I talked about the sort of presuppositionalism. God, you know, we talk about this, and some people will say, in talking about apologetics, do you like the teleological or the cosmological or the argument from complexity or the moral argument? What's your favorite argument? My favorite argument is you tell them that I am. That's what you tell them. How am I going to convince these people? You just tell them I am. And God shows himself, and he simply asserts himself. Now, I don't mean that those other arguments don't have value. But sometimes we get so far down into the complexities of those arguments that we forget that God doesn't think he needs to make that case for himself. He simply says, I am. And at some point, we're going to have to back up away from the structures that we've built, which may have some inconsistencies and holes in them from time to time, and simply acknowledge that without God, there is nothing. So when you're engaging, let's say, with somebody who doesn't believe in God, and they say, let's set all of our presuppositions to the side. All right, here's the problem. That would mean they would have to set aside their presupposition that God does not exist. You see, that's a presupposition. And it's not, it's, you can't be neutral on the question of whether or not God exists. There are two options. He does or he does not. They have said, let's start with he does not. Okay, what you're saying is set aside my presuppositions, but not yours. We can't. We cannot operate there. And so I think we're conceding ground when we start with the notion that God is not there. And then the only way to rationalize ourselves there is to start somewhere. Where we start? We start here? Okay. Well, again, you're engaging in mental gymnastics, and you're trying to get back to your presupposition by accepting their presupposition. I think we need to inculcate in our minds and in our children's minds the notion that when somebody says, oh, I don't believe in God, I think that's tantamount to saying, I believe in a flat earth. That's like somebody saying, I don't believe in gravity. Now, I don't have to be obnoxious to that person. Let me ask you this. If somebody said, somebody you worked with, and let's say you're working in a factory, and you're just doing your job, right? It's not a very complex job. And somebody goes, you know, I believe in a flat earth. You'd be like, okay. I mean, that's a take. Or they say, I don't know if I believe in this whole gravity thing. You're like, all right, man, you know, cool story. You could get along with that guy, right? But would you want him to build anything for you? Like a bridge that requires some beliefs in reality? Now, what we say is, you know, somebody who doesn't believe in God can build a bridge. I understand that. But we just need to acknowledge this person's whole premise of the world is off. I do think it should change our minds about, do we want this person telling us about what's wrong with the way we think? I've got disordered emotions. So I'm going to go to a guy who doesn't even believe that those are created by our Creator and let him tell me how to fix that. We just want to be real careful about that and about our assumptions about how that affects worldview. Not believing in God is a major presupposition that affects everything. So. Yeah. Right. Well, I believe he falls into the self-evident category. All right. So from that, then we need to put him at the center of everything. This is where we'll spend the rest of our time. We don't have much time to spend. And so I want to talk about this for a few minutes. There is no thing that has nothing to do with God. There is no thing that has nothing to do with God. When we start, we talked about this before, when we start talking about whether or not something is secular or religious, I do believe that God makes distinctions in the nature of how something relates to him. So we've been talking about Leviticus, and Gail had the chart up here about what is unclean, what is holy, and what was the one in the middle? Clean. Unclean, clean, and holy. And you see terms like profane. Profane is not the way we use the term profane. It just means not holy. It's common, right? And then, of course, there is uncleanness, right? That's another step away from profane and cleanse and so forth. There is a distinction between how you come, quote, into the presence of God. Now, there's a sense in which you're always in the presence of God. But there's a special terminology that means coming before him to worship in ceremonial ways. And there are expectations and there are distinctions. And so Paul would say about that distinction, when you are assembled as the church. And so what he's talking about there has a context, and that is distinct from when you're not assembled at the church. And so there are certain ways of doing things when you're assembled at the church that don't just apply to everyday life, right? Yeah, all that's granted. But what about when you're not assembled? God is there too. And he has something to say about what you're doing when you're not assembled. And I think one of the things about the restoration is that the restoration focused primarily on the restoration of forms for the assembly. And it neglected in large measure forms outside the assembly, transformed lives, right? And it said, you know, we've churches are not operating how they ought to. The organization of those churches, the worship of those churches, you know, all of these things, we need to reform the way the church operates. We do. We also need to restore the way Christians at an individual level operate. And in fact, the restoration of the church ought to flow from restored lives, right? And so they ought to work hand in hand. And we, I think, in the restoration movement in general, have neglected that applying some of those same concepts that we applied to the restoration of the institution to the lives that make up that institution. In the book of Leviticus, the law regulates every part of life. Leviticus 19, he says, right after he makes the statement, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, which is, we're like, you know, yes, I mean, obviously, we preach that. Then he says, you are to keep my statutes. You shall not breed together two kinds of cattle. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed, nor wear a garment upon you of two kinds of material mixed together. This is the sort of commandment that people love to mock. I don't know if you've seen in response to people talking about homosexuality, and they'll go, yeah, the same book that condemns homosexuality condemns a poly-cotton blend. So what are you doing with that, Christians? And if, I'm afraid Christians go, yeah, that is a weird law. That's a law from God. It says something. Now, you may not understand, I may not fully understand everything that God is saying there, but he's not just being silly. And he's not being arbitrary. God means to communicate something. I think in this, he means to communicate an acknowledgement of proper distinctions. That there are separateness. And that's one of the things that the law communicates frequently is a separateness of order and kind. And primarily that playing out in the separateness of us as an order and kind from the rest of the world. And so he's communicating that through, I might say, mundane laws about how you treat your cattle and what kind of clothes you wear. In verse 27, it says, "You shall not round off the side growth of your heads, nor harm the edges of your beard." Again, people are like, you know, God cares. Apparently in the Old Testament, he cares about haircuts. He does. I think he still cares about haircuts. You know, somebody brought up that used to wearing a beard would get you fired. And it's because it communicated something. Haircuts still communicate something. And God still cares about what we're communicating. And so when you go to the barber, you should not be thinking, this is just about what I think about what I want to look like. You should be thinking about what God thinks about what you look like. And take that thought process with you into that everyday, mundane activity. Well, on and on, we go back to chapter 11, of course. God regulates the food, the meats that they could eat. Don't eat this. You can't eat this. Here's clean. Here's unclean. He makes those separations and distinctions. In chapter 14, God is not only regulating health, and he talks about leprosy, and I love the flow chart. He talks about leprosy and how to deal with that. But that leprosy is not only in your body. It's in the house. And so if you've got mold or mildew, he has something to say about that. Think about that. God tells you what to do when there's mold in your house. He says that's a religious experience, is finding mold in your house, and here's how you deal with it. Now, the world's made a different sort of religious experience out of that. But God has something to say about that. In Exodus chapter 23 and in verse 19, God says, don't boil a goat in its mother's milk. You ever read that command? Do you know that that command gets repeated multiple times? One of the things that is astonishing to me about that particular command, don't boil a goat in its mother's milk, is that it's repeated in Exodus chapter 33, I think. But it's right after, it may be 34. I think it is 34, actually. So after they're reestablishing the covenant with God after the golden calf in chapter 32, there's a brief repetition, just a few laws. He's trying to get them back on track. You've gone to idolatry. I want to get you back on track. Here's some things you need to remember. If you were to walk through, starting in Exodus 20, and look at all the commands, and they had gotten off course, and you're thinking, I've got a few commands I want to remind them of, would don't boil a goat in its mother's milk be one of them? It's one of them that God thought was important enough to repeat. Let me get you back on track. Don't do this. I think that means that he's not just saying, hey, here's a weird thing I don't want you to do. It must be a fundamental thing he doesn't want them to do. And it's saying things about how they view his creation and how they view the harmony of his creation. And I think what he's doing is commanding them to stay away from perverse things. There is a certain perversity in taking this child of a goat and using its own mother's milk to cook it in. Don't think that way. Don't allow yourself to be so numb that you would think nothing of something like that. In like manner, he says, when you come upon a nest, take the eggs, but don't take the eggs and the mother. Don't be a ravager of nature. Use, yes, what God has given you, but don't think it's just for you to take and take and take and never leave anything. Be self-controlled in the way you operate with God's creation. So we could go on and on. But here's the point. Under the law, there was not a waking moment. There was not a decision that you could make that God had not said something about. You could not go to the bathroom, but that God had told you how to deal with it. Do you realize that? When you relieved yourself, he told you how to deal with that and how to bury it, what to do with that. So people would say, I get this question all the time. I say, everything has to do with God. So you're saying when I'm in the bedroom and I'm with my wife, that has to do with it. Yes, that is his. He has told you about that. He has told you what the good of it is, what the purpose of it is. Multiple purposes. And we want to acknowledge and give him regard even in that. Somebody will say, what does going to the bathroom have to do with God? Who do you think designed that system? And I'll tell you what, you never acknowledge God more than when that system's not working. I mean it. And then you're like, whew, thank you, when it becomes operational again. I'm not just being silly there. I mean, we ought to acknowledge God in everything. We ought to acknowledge the connectivity of God. Now, when we get to the New Testament and say, well, God doesn't regulate it anymore. Do you think that's because he doesn't want to say anything about it anymore? Or because he wants us to have gained the maturity without meticulous regulation to understand what it all has to do with him? When we get to the New Testament, it's not that God doesn't care about clean and unclean foods anymore. But rather, Paul says, sanctification comes through gratitude. Now, what makes our food clean? That we acknowledge who gave it to us, and we are thankful to him. And when you don't do that, you are eating unclean food. God has not abandoned the premise. It has just come to maturity. And what we want to do as we read the law is not look at that and say, well, that doesn't have anything to do with me anymore. One of the laws, I think maybe Deuteronomy 22, I can't remember which one of those it is. It tells them to build a parapet on the roof of their house. And do you remember why? So nobody will fall off. When you build your house, build it in a way that is not unsafe for your guests. Think about people when you build things. So, you know, I can't stand OSHA just like every other construction worker, but what they're doing is a lot of what God has said. Be thoughtful about the safety of people. Now, I won't get into that. I think we can do a better job than government regulation if we're careful, if we're thoughtful. But that's just the degree. And again, what we do, because some liberal organization or government institution who doesn't know what they're doing comes in and says, here's all the ways that you can do this, we push back and we throw away even the concept that we ought to be thinking about those. Because the EPA can be so bonkers, we forget that God has said, don't ravage my creation. Well, I'll agree with you that they're not, that the EPA, who doesn't even acknowledge the existence of God, is not in the best place to tell me how to avoid ravaging God's creation. But I don't want to be a ravager of God's creation. So I take that mentality into everything I do. And I want to discover and think about how to insert God into my every waking moment. How do I do this in a Christian way? I'll give you one more example, and I need to move on. We at Pepper Road, some of the guys, we've had softball teams, or we might get out and play softball with each other, or flag football we were playing recently, or kickball. And, when we had a team, an organized team, a lot of times the Baptist church has got a team, right? And you know at the end of the game what they do. They circle up in the middle of the field and they say a prayer. And one day a guy said, jokingly, he goes, "Yeah, we don't do that." And he was joking. But it hit me. We don't. Because we think God has nothing to do with what we just did. But God has something to do with everything we do. And I acknowledge that there are ways that that gets abused and that we don't need to paint Philippians 4:13 on our, you know, hats and so forth. However, we should sanctify that with gratitude and acknowledge, too, that there's a Christian way to go about doing that, and there's a very unchristian way to go about doing that. And we want to go about it the Christian way. Have you ever thought about this? In the church, in organizational activity, we say that whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord. And we need command, example, necessary. We need a positive authority for whatever we do. Do you think that you need that for your everyday activity? I do nothing unless my Father has spoken it. I don't act without His guidance. One time I preached a lesson on the authority for recreation. I had a guy come up to me and say, "That's the weirdest lesson I've ever heard." And he said, "Why do we need authority for playing games?" Because we need authority for everything. Because He's the Master and the Lord. And if we can't find authority, we need to burn all the games. Now, I think we can. But I think we need to be thoughtful that we need that, not just in the assemblies, but spread it out into all of our lives. Well, along these lines, we need to stop fragmenting our life. Again, sacred, secular. But instead, live our lives entirely by His authority. In Colossians chapter 1 and verse 15, it says, "Who is the image of the invisible God? Who is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation? For in Him all things were created, both in the heavens and on the earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through Him and for Him. He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. He's the head of the body of the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that He Himself will come to have first place in everything." We need to think and talk as if the world does not move, does not act without His guidance. How many of you have seen Shenandoah with Jimmy Stewart? Yeah. All right. So Jimmy Stewart in that movie is a bitter man caught in between the factions of the Civil War. And he wants nothing to do with it. In one of the scenes, they're about to eat, and he says a prayer. All his sons and children gathered around, and he says, "Well, his wife has died." And I get the idea she would have been a much better prayer than he is. But anyway, he says, "Well, we planted it. We worked the fields. I don't remember what else he said. We worked dog-bone hard for it, but we thank you anyway." And the idea is, we made this grow. We're the ones who put this on our table. And I guess we'll give you thanks because you say to. I'm going to tell you what, you do all that work. If God is not involved, that seed will do nothing. He gives the increase. I have a friend. We were talking about these things, and he said he was planting some corn, and he was getting some help from one of the brethren there and learning. And they got all the corn planted, and while they're still in the dirt, just on their knees, he says, "Now, let's pray for rain." And he said it was embarrassing that he had not considered that that would be the next thing to do. Because in his mind, well, we got a garden hose. We can bring the water if we need to. It didn't occur to him how important and integral asking God's participation in this would be. And I'll tell you what, it's easy to think that way. Again, that modernist mindset. What do I need God for? I've got all the tools I need to do this. I tell you what, you can bring water. Eventually, if it doesn't drop from above, even where you're getting it from will run out. But nevertheless, I tell you what you can't do, can't make it stop. For all of our abilities to move water from one place to another, we can't make it stop. And my tomato plant sure wished it would have. And I know a lot of farmers in my area who are more dependent on what they put in the ground who wished it would have. And so, we pray. Several years ago, it wasn't raining, and the Georgia governor called for people to pray. And it was a moment of desperation that a governor of a state in our country would say, y'all pray. And he got mercilessly mocked. But we need to pray. And then we need to be more aware and acknowledge when the prayer is granted. I love the innocence and the simple acknowledgement of children. I remember last year we had a particularly dry year, and we had been praying for rain regularly. And one day we left and it was raining, and my son says, hey, it's raining. And I said, oh, it is. He said, we've been praying for that. I said, we have. And he goes, and God made it happen. He did. So let's thank him for that. And you know, I don't know if y'all have heard, you know, seen the sort of meme of the dad saying, we sure needed this rain. Apparently, I've affected my son in that way, because every time it does rain, no matter how long it's been raining or how many days in a row, Rylan prays, we sure needed this rain, God. But I tell you, there is no neutral territory. There's nowhere that you can take a neutral position on God. He is in the midst of everything, and we need to act like it. We need to recognize that you can't teach history from a neutral position. If what that means is, I'll leave God out of it, that is not a neutral decision. The most important moment in history is when God came to this earth and was put on a cross and died. That is more affecting to all of history than anything that has happened in history. You leave that out, that's not neutral. You leave out that God is the reason the world exists, that's not neutral. And in the book of Revelation, when you're teaching through the history of what is happening in the Roman Empire, God says, that's me too. You cannot teach it without God, without having assaulted his authority. So that's not neutral. You can't teach science without the one who created all of that creation that we observe. You can't even teach math without saying God is the one who has made a reality that is so constant and so reliable that we can come up with these theories. And the men who came up with those theories believe that. And we, our atheists, teachers, are robbing God and pretending they don't need him for what they've robbed him of. We should not be participants in that. So, put God back at the center of our minds, our education, our whole view of the world. Well, we'll pick up there and continue on tomorrow. Appreciate y'all's good attention.